Welcome to the Skeptic Canary Radio Show with Tom Williamson.
Good evening, everyone. It is the 17th of February, 2015. You are listening to episode 61 of the Skeptic Canary Show. I'm Tom Williamson from skepticcanary.com, and with me is Dr. Geraint Parry.
Hello, everyone.
Paul Mark Hopwood.
Good evening, everybody.
And joining us for the first time in the show's current incarnation, it's Ashley James Price.
Hello.
Hello. Good to have you on board.
Thanks. Great to be here again.
Excellent. And Ash, you bring with you your own feature. We've got more features than I've got on my face.
But they are a bit prettier. No, Tom.
Yes, they are. Thank you. Oh, going to have a try now. Right. So, before we do anything else, something I do have to say is, Geraint, since we last recorded, yes, you've had a big old birthday. You are now 40, so happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
Yes, so what did you get up to? I heard you went off to Madrid and went to the Bernabeu, took in El Clasico.
Funny, Tom. No, we took a trip to Lisbon with a few notable skeptics from the Merseyside area and some other pals. We had a pretty big night on the booze on Saturday, which the details of which are not suitable for such a family podcast. And then after recovering all day on the Sunday, we went to watch Sporting Lisbon against Benfica at the Sporting Stadium. So it was fun, definitely. It's a bit it was a lively match. Bottles being thrown beforehand, flares being thrown into the stands. So it was a bit livelier than our usual Norwich versus Preston North End or something, Tom. So, yeah, it was good. Thank you.
Excellent.
40 years old. Golly.
Excellent. Fantastic. And one thing we have done is decided to make your science news into official feature, which is going to be called Geraint's Science Update.
Well, a great name, isn't it? Really?
Yes.
You need some hard hitting news at 10 style jingle music.
Yes. You wait until you hear it. Wait until I record it. Right, so we've got Geraint's science updates, we've got Paul's coffee morning, got Ash's cabinet of the intransigently bizarre that we've decided to call it.
I'm really pleased. I'm excited to find out what intransigently means.
Yes.
So just to check, I'm guessing that we blew the budget on coming up with the name for Ash's feature, and that meant there was nothing left for coming up with a name for Geraint. I'm guessing is how it's worked out.
I wanted to call it Geraint Parry's Sciencey Fun Time, but that was vetoed.
This is a serious item, Tom. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it does sound like something out of Borat.
Exactly.
It's science, it's nice! I'm not doing that again.
Good. We've also got the quandary, where we're going to discuss measles vaccinations. Well, vaccinations in general. And, of course, we have the ultimate feature, the return of Flag News.
Flag News.
But we're teasing with that. We're going to put that right at the end because everyone loves Flag News. They're going to be hanging on for it. It's going to be like when the 11 o'clock show put Ali G on last so that everyone else would watch the rest of the stuff. Right. Okay, first feature is the competition. That doesn't really have a name, but the question last time was, what bits of woo have you been given as a present? And we had a deluge of entries. We had one. It was Emma McClure from Merseyside Skeptics, of course, with a magic wand that she was given from the Undergroby Magic Wand Factory. Now, I've seen pictures of it, and I can't work out if it's a serious gift or not. I don't think it is, because it is spectacularly ugly.
And I want this wand. My magic shows it will work perfect.
Yeah, I might put a picture up of it on the website somewhere. And it's an extraordinary item, because it talks about you wave a wand, and if you believe the wish will come true, then it will. And if the wand breaks, then that's a good thing, and it meant to break at that time. You only need to buy a new one if you break it 7 times.
Ah, wow!
Same as a Horcrux.
Yes,
it's got quite an extravagant handle on it. And a picture. So the witch's head and hat is the handle. It looks like to me, and she's quite a ruddy cheeked lady, isn't she? I think the witch.
Yeah.
She looks quite happy to be a witch. That's nice.
Yes.
She looks like she's been hammering the gin a bit hard, if you
want. Maybe that. Well, those two things aren't mutually exclusive.
Okay, so... Okay, so this week's question is, what experiences have you had with street preachers? We want to know. And the prize is a copy of John Ronson's latest book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which isn't out yet, but you'll get your copy when it is. Entry by March 3rd for entries, and entries to tom@skepticcanary.com. tom@skepticcanary.com, what experiences have you had with street preachers?
That sounds like a leading question to me. So have you had any interesting occurrences?
Well, thank you for asking. Well, there's one street preacher in Liverpool who I'm sure we've all seen if we've been to Liverpool. He has a sort of, he talks like a Scouse Winston Churchill. He talks a little bit like this, you know. He's got that sort of weird utterance way of speaking. But he only really, really knocked me off once. Because he's an extraordinary guy, because not only does he believe in the end times and, you know, the world's going to come to an end soon, but he also believes in the Illuminati.
Ah.
He made that very clear one day. And basically any natural disaster is a sign of the end times. And he mentioned the Japanese tsunami, you know, when the Fukushima power plant blew up, essentially.
Yep.
And he mentioned it just after my little brother had to come home, because he'd gone over to Japan to work, and I thought, it's a bit of a cheap shot, mate. And I shouted at him, to my shame.
Well, did he know that your brother was coming home?
No, of course not. But, you know, it's when someone mentions something that someone you know is, well, not just someone you know, but someone you're related to is personally involved in, and you just think, a bit opportunist, mate. I know he's a street preacher, but hey.
But he didn't know, though. He didn't know your brother was involved, so.
No, but I was still annoyed at him.
Okay. Maybe he's a psychic and a street preacher. That's good.
Yes, maybe.
Going, indeed.
So that's this week's competition. What experiences have you had with street preachers?
Dr. Geraint Parry's Science Update.
So, Geraint, what's happening in the world of science this week?
Well, I just wanted to flag up a story which some people might have seen in across other media as well. It's been pretty well publicised, but it's kind of links in Darwin Day. So it was Darwin Day last week, the anniversary of Darwin's birthday on the 12th of February. And there was a nice paper which was published online in Nature, which kind of links together his observations in the Galapagos with more contemporary genomic work. So a group based mostly in Sweden has put together this paper, a nice paper, where they've taken the 15 species of finch which live on the Galapagos, and these were the species of bird which Darwin noticed at the time that he visited there and thought, they're very similar, but they're a bit different. It could have been they might have originated from a single species, and it was this and another species that he developed his theory of natural selection, which we're all grateful for, of course. So the researchers in this group have gone back to those islands and have taken samples from each of the finches, which live on these different islands on the archipelago, and they've sequenced these, and they've shown on a genetic level. So what they've done, you know, people will have heard about the Human Genome Project, so you sequence all the information within a person's genome. So they've essentially done exactly the same thing, just with the finches instead. So they've, you know, this is quite trivial technology actually at the moment, and it's not that expensive these days. So they've taken the DNA from all these finches, sequenced them, and then they've shown, and the morphology we see in the finches actually corresponds to what we see on the genomic level. So it's kind of interesting in that way. So they basically looked at a situation where there's been adaptation due to geographic isolation, and they showed on a genomic level that corresponds to what they see within the within the DNA of the organisms. And they went, a little more complicated than that, but they went one step further in that they were able to identify then a gene, a particular gene. It's called ALX1. It doesn't matter what that stands for, mostly because they don't know. And they found that this gene is very important. So there's two distinct morphologies. So the finches, which kind of live on the ground and eat seeds, they have very large, much larger beaks, much stronger beaks, because they need to crush those seeds. Whereas the ones which kind of live in the trees and feed on insects have much sharper, pointier beaks. And they showed, by this doing this genome sequencing, they showed there's two distinct varieties of this one gene which correspond to the differences in the beaks. So the ones with the fat beaks have a particular type of this gene, whereas the ones with the thin beaks have a different type. So it's a nice, they can show that there's a nice correlation between the morphology and the morphology of the beak and the actual gene itself. And then adding an extra layer on that, we know that gene also is involved in facial development in mammals as well. And humans with a defect in that do have a number of facial abnormalities. So it kind of ties it all nicely in together. And I think these guys are pretty smart. So I'm sure they could have used a lot of different examples of kind of adaptive evolution. But using the Darwin example certainly means that they're going to get a higher impact out of this. So it's been published in Nature, which is nice. But also people are going to publicize it because people know about the finches. So they've been a bit smart that they've applied for this grant. They've got the money to do it, knowing that they'll get some good publicity at the end of it if they come up with anything interesting. So it's a nice little study. So people should check it out. Maybe, Tom, you can put a link on the on the page that we can link to the story so people can have a look at it themselves.
Certainly. So, well, that's a lovely story, really. So Darwin's finches, you know, cornerstone of the formation of his theory of evolution.
Yep.
And there's now a genetic reason for the differences between the morphology of their beaks.
Exactly right.
Fantastic. I still think it's amazing that something like that can follow such a reductionist view. So beak difference, one gene.
Yes, indeed. So the actual function of the gene is pretty, so it's a transcription factor. So that's a sort of protein which binds to the DNA controlling other proteins. So the likelihood is that gene will have an effect on many other genes. But so it's that effect which might be different in different species and between different organisms as well. But certainly they can, you're right, that it can come down to this difference between the two this one gene. But then how that acts isn't quite as simple, and there's more work needs to be done to define this precise function of this protein as it happens. So, but yeah, you're right in that way.
Yeah, just when you thought the evidence in support of natural selection couldn't get any more overwhelming. but just one question while we're on the subject, Karain. Am I right in saying that Tom mentioned the reductionist view, but am I right in saying that the genes can possibly have more than one trait? Because my understanding about people who live in malaria hotspots is that they have developed a genetic resistance to the condition, but apparently the same gene that's responsible for that increased resistance is also responsible for making them more vulnerable to sickle cell anemia. But because the evolutionary advantage vastly outweighs the disadvantage, it therefore sticks around.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's a very classic example of incomplete dominance within a gene. So yeah, you're right. So in the genetics behind that is in sub-Saharan African regions, for the most part, there is a form of hemoglobin, so the protein which carries oxygen around the body, which is mutated, and that therefore gives people sickle cells, so they can't carry oxygen as well, and they're iller. But there's a side benefit of that in that the malarial parasite, which requires, it infects blood cells and requires a healthy blood system to work, it can't affect the sickle cell-shaped red blood cells as well. So therefore, those people who have sickle cell have a selective advantage over people with normal red blood cells. So usually, in that case, those people with sickle celling would have been selected against, and that gene probably would have been lost, it's more than likely. But because they have this selective advantage over malarial, in cases of malaria, then that has been maintained within the population. So it's very true that, yeah, one gene and one protein can have many roles, and it's very much in the context of where that protein might be within the organism. So if you have a gene and therefore a protein which is expressed in the face of an organism, it might do one thing, but if you express it in a different part, then it might do something entirely different. So gene expression and protein function is very much conceptual on the the region where it is expressed within the organism, certainly. It's not as complex as just one gene does that, that's for sure.
One of the things about sickle cell anemia and learning about it is you realise that genetics is really a cruel lottery, because if you've got one copy of the mutated version of a gene, then you're fine. If you've got two copies, you've got sickle cell anemia. If you don't have any copies, then you don't have that protection against malaria. And it's just really complete luck of the draw what you end up with. But yeah.
What tickets you've got in the lottery, yes.
Yeah, but it just reminded me how absolutely cruel evolution can be, and how evolution doesn't have a conscience, which is certainly something that I think some creationists have a problem with grasping.
Yeah, that's true. Selfish, indeed, genes can be.
Yep, there we are.
There's a bit Yoda there for some reason. I don't know why.
That was Geraint Parry's Science Update. Our next feature is Paul's Coffee Morning. It's Paul Hopwood's Coffee Morning. Paul, what have you been discussing at your coffee shop this week, if that makes any sense?
We've been discussing fairies at the bottom of the garden, Tom.
Oh, okay.
Would this be the Cottingley fairies by any chance?
It wasn't the Cottingley fairies. Okay. It was a discussion inspired by a customer who I saw reading a book titled Seeing Fairies, which you can find on Amazon, which I'm looking at now, which, before I go any further, I would just like to point out I'm not casting any dispersions against this particular customer. I have no idea as to the reasons why they were reading it. But given that on my, shall we say, very rudimentary explorations of this particular topic, which, quite unsurprisingly to me, pointed in the direction of there is no evidence to support the existence of fairies, it did seem quite a weighty tome, I'd say around about the 400-page mark, to be able to spin out from no evidence whatsoever. But it turns out that this is a collection of the lost archives of the Fairy Investigation Society, which is always a surprise when you find out that such an organisation exists. And having had a brief look around, I have to say I wasn't aware that this particular, I don't know what to call it, I wouldn't call it a type of woo. What would be a fair way of terming belief in the existence of fairies?
Woo?
Yeah, I'd call it woo, I'm afraid.
You would? Okay, fair enough. No, that's fine. I bow to those more learned than I. I'm but a humble master's graduate. And so I just decided to have a close look, because quite simply, this is not one that I had paid any particular attention to. Now, the one that Ash mentioned is the Cottingley Fairies, which is, I remember watching a documentary on many, many moons ago, as far as I recall, was a series of photographs taken by two sisters in the early part of the 20th century that appeared to show the existence of fairies at the bottom of their garden, and which nobody was able to debunk. 1917, thank you. And I seem to recall that at the time nobody was able to debunk them, but apparently one of them admitted just before they died that they had in fact mocked the whole thing up. But outside of that, I really was struggling for any point of reference, so I just thought I'd throw this one up, because it's, shall I say, a fresh piece of meat. We've had the last couple of weeks, rather than the usual... Indeed, well, we are a Scandinavian restaurant, so... Sorry, Scandinavian cafe, I do beg your pardon, so there should be some meat in there in there somewhere. But this seemed, to me, a particularly fresh one, so I just thought I'd throw it out there and see what you guys knew and understood and what you thought.
Well, fairy sightings, there's been some recently, in, I think, 2014 or 2013, where a chap, I believe he was associated with a university or an institute of learning, certainly, and he took some photographs, and they apparently showed fairies fluttering around, and they do look like they have two legs, two arms, and they do look like they have wings, and they're fluttering around, but they were likely just midges. Sadly, not as interesting as supernatural fairies.
The Cottingley fairies, but the 1917, wasn't it a very, very early example of photo manipulation, sort of like the Photoshop of its day?
No,
that was my understanding.
No?
It wasn't actually any photo doctoring at all. It was far, far simpler than that. What they did, the two young girls, was they simply cut out images from a from a magazine, from a newspaper or a book or something like that, and they just positioned them around and then posed with them. And you can actually see when you look at the photographs that there should have been a really clear tell as to how this was done, because the waterfall in the background was blurry, because obviously it's a long exposure with older cameras, whereas the wings and the legs and the movements of the fairies is perfectly crystal clear. So that should have given away how it was done by the fact that they...
I'm looking at that photograph now, and I see exactly what you mean, yes.
They look incredibly fake, I've got to say, looking at the pictures. And so Ash has just sent us a link about that, the picture about the university professor, and they're clearly just like moths or butterflies or midges or something, as you said. It's funny. People can make a story out of anything, really, I've got to say.
Yeah, and I mean, with the Cottingley fairies, especially Arthur Conan Doyle, was a big, big believer in them. He wrote a book, and part of that book did discuss the Cottingley fairies, and he was a big believer that they were genuine. And it's bizarre thinking of Arthur Conan Doyle as the creator of Sherlock Holmes, one of the most rational, logical detectives of all time. And yet Arthur Conan Doyle was a complete and total opposite of his creation.
Yeah, and so I don't really know much about the etymology of the word fairy, but it can be a real broad descriptor of, you know, something like a will-o'-the-wisp, so like a beam of light dancing in the mists or something, or an actual idea of a physical form sort of thing. So, you know, I don't know. I'm sure that's why there was such a long book, Paul, that they could discuss all these different types of what these fairies might be, I suppose, I'm guessing.
Indeed, and the one thing that interests me is, keep remembering, don't say psychologist, psychology graduate, is this human tendency to want to believe the most fantastic explanation.
Yeah, and
despite evidence to the contrary, this is not something I really looked into, but I would like to at some point, you know, to want to believe that fairies exist, that we can speak to the dead, which is something that Ash will come on to later. Apologies for the slightly premature segue.
No, but yeah, I think it is an interesting topic, because out of all of these supernatural and paranormal occurrences, fairies could, they're physical entities, they're biological, they're animal life form, basically. So they're maybe not as far-fetched as some of the other occult and supernatural beliefs that exist. I'm not saying that the existence of fairies is particularly likely, but they're certainly less unlikely, I think, than maybe ghosts.
The possibility is more plausible, yes.
Well, fairies are at least of this world, and ghosts are just...
Yeah.
Ghosts are just nothing.
Ghosts break the second law of thermodynamics, yes.
Well, they break pretty much every law of physics, chemistry... Whatever you
I
want
don't
to
know
say,
why
really.
I would say they're more likely. I mean, it's just I guess they could be the definition or what people think of they are. They could be, I suppose, mistaken for some sort of small animal or something like that. I mean, in that sense. I mean, they're just made up in the same way that ghosts are and everything else, right? It's all very, in that sense, it's all similar. I mean, there's no chance of there being a tiny human being which flits around the place.
Well, no, the point is that fairies are at least physical entities. They are of this universe. They are of this dimension. Whereas a ghost is meant to be something that has died and inhabits some sort of other realm that in some way comes back and interacts with this realm. And you know, for a ghost to exist, you've got to have life after death, and you've got to have an interaction of where we exist with some other sort of plane, and it's just pretty much physically impossible. But a fairy is hypothesized to be a little person with wings.
I mean, also it's not just restricted to that, because Morgan Le Fay. From Arthurian legend, the fae part of Morgan Le Fay, Morgan the fairy, basically. So she was a human-sized one. So I guess there's all sorts of different definitions of fairy out there.
Is what is pretty varied, isn't it? I think that's the takeaway from that, for sure.
Okay. Any other thoughts on fairies?
I'm all fairied out.
And just say well done us for not making any fairy liquid jokes, I guess.
Oh, not bad.
Okay then, that was, thank you very much everyone, that was Paul's Coffee Morning. It's Paul Hopwood's coffee morning. And now we move on to Ash Price's Cabinet of the Intransigently Bizarre.
Ooh. Welcome, stranger, to Ash Price's Cabinet of the Intransigently Bizarre.
So, Ash, what is in the cabinet this week?
Well, what's in the cabinet this week is quite possibly my most favourite, if that's a quite correct grammatical way of saying it, my favouritist medium, and that is Helen Duncan. Have we heard of Helen Duncan?
I have, because I've seen your show, Ash.
Yes.
I have not. Wasn't she on Blue Peter? No.
I think for a short period of time, yeah. Certainly there was a lot of making things herself from things lying around that came into it with what she was doing. Helen Duncan was the last person, and this is the common way it tends to be phrased, Helen Duncan was the last person imprisoned as a witch in the UK, and this was in 1944, except she wasn't. The confusion comes in by the fact that she was imprisoned under the Witchcraft Act of 1735, an admittedly archaic act at the time, but it was about dealing with fraudulent mediums. It was about dealing with people who intentionally deceived, and Helen Duncan that's what she was arrested and charged with, and not just once. She was arrested three times in her life, once in 1933, once in 1944, and once in 1956. And the first two times, she actually went to court and was found guilty. Here in Edinburgh in 1933, she was found guilty of fraud, and she was fined £10. And then in England in 1944, she was again found guilty, under the Witchcraft Act. But other things people kind of forget about Helen Duncan's imprisonment and her trial and everything. Well, she wasn't the only one on trial. Her manager was on trial, and she was also found guilty and imprisoned for a short period of time. So Helen Duncan's actually one of the last two people imprisoned under the Witchcraft Act. And the couple who helped organise the séance, for which Helen Duncan was accused of fraud, were also on trial. Although they were found guilty, they were given a suspended sentence because the judge believed they had been deceived by Duncan just as much as everyone else. And she used to do all sorts of things. She was caught out several times. During her seances, people would lunge forward when she made a ghostly spirit appear. And when they grabbed out at the ghostly spirit, it turned out to be a doll that she had made. Other times when they lunged forward, they found it was Helen Duncan herself. One of the things Duncan used to do was bring up ectoplasm, and she would sit on stage and she would bring up this supernatural gunge that would be brought up through her mouth. And she was one of the most prominent people to do it. It was discovered, however, when people investigated takings and samples of this ectoplasm, it was just things like cheesecloth, or occasionally it was egg white mixed with paper. So she was constantly being caught out for deceiving people, and was prosecuted successfully twice for it. But she's one of the most interesting people, because she's still very, very much supported by modern people who believe in psychic abilities. It's quite common to hear people accuse the situation of being persecuting her for her beliefs and for her abilities, when that's not the case at all. It's also quite common to hear people say, well, of course there are some psychics who are fake, but the rest are real. Except for when we expose those fakes, like Helen Duncan, those same people tend to leap on board and say, well, no, miscarriage of justice. So people still do support Helen Duncan. There's been a recent attempt to try and get her posthumously exonerated, which has not gone through, which has failed. But she's here in Scotland. She gets commemorated. I live out in Preston Pans, just outside of Edinburgh, and there's a mural to her here in Preston Pans. Because the east coast of Scotland has a lot of history associated with witchcraft, like the North Berwick witches. So she's still a very, very prominent figure 60 years after her death and 70 years after her imprisonment. And I just find the whole story of Helen Duncan to be absolutely fascinating, because, like I say, she was caught out several times. She submitted for testing to Harry Price, a very well-known psychic investigator, and she ran out of his laboratory screaming and shouting. And at that point, it was believed that she switched her ectoplasm with her husband so that no one could actually find it on her when they examined her. So she's absolutely fascinating. And Harry Price himself, I actually have a quote that he gave from the investigation, and he said, "Could anything be more infantile than a group of grown-up men wasting time, money and energy on the antics of a fat female crook?"
Wow. Indeed. I'm looking at the pictures on her Wikipedia site, and the cheesecloth as ectoplasm looks absolutely ridiculous.
It does, but it's also disgusting. And you have to remember, when you go and see at this time, 30s and 40s were kind of the heyday of ectoplasm. When you go and see them, you effectively...
Well, I would argue the heyday of ectoplasm was...
The 80s.
Exactly, in the first Ghostbusters film, in the library, definitely. In the hotel, sorry, in the hotel at the start. Yeah.
It was also in the library, wasn't it? There was supernatural guns dripping off the...
Well, there was, at the very start, yes. Yeah. Yes.
And then Slimer, of course.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. Completely unrelated as well. I'm just playing the Ghostbusters game, and you get slime gun. It's brilliant. Right. It's fantastic. Yeah. Around zapping things, spraying gunge.
I heard you mention. So you said she was imprisoned for essentially intentional deceit. That was the phrase, I think.
She was she was charged with a total of seven counts is what she was charged with, and two of those were taken from the Witchcraft Act as well. And I'm just trying to find the discussion that Sir Gerald Dodson, the judge, discussed.
I'm just thinking it would be nice if you could get imprisoned these days for intentional deceit, then some of our psychic friends might think twice about going about their business, I'd say.
So yes, on the charges that she was under, there was two related to the Witchcraft Act, and the rest were relating to claiming money under false pretenses and public mischief.
Yeah, okay.
That's what she was found guilty of. And the thing is, her defense lawyer was absolutely terrible, absolutely awful defense lawyer. Really, when you look at the court transcripts, he brought in quite a lot of witnesses. 28 of them were not present at the seance for which Helen was arrested. They were just satisfied clients.
Wow.
And they were brought in to defend this specific charge.
That's impressive.
Okay.
Yeah.
In fairness, that's a good example about why anecdotal evidence is regarded as the lowest quality of evidence can collect. And I wish that was a line that could be used more often in arguments with various groups. You know, do you think this could stand up in a court of law?
Yep, absolutely. It's one of the most fascinating cases, I think, in British history. And it did, I think, if not directly, it did in part at least lead to the repeal of the Witchcraft Act. And it was replaced in 1951 with the Fraudulent Mediums Act. So I think the case had an impact on the British legal system generally, as well as an impact on spiritualism.
Absolutely, yeah. I didn't realise there was a Fraudulent Mediums Act. So that's something.
There isn't anymore.
Replaced. Okay.
If I'm right in thinking, I think it was replaced in 2008.
Okay.
With consumer protection from unfair trading. I think that kind of covered everything. There's a lot of mediums throughout history. There's a lot of people involved in spiritualism, such as the Fox sisters, who originated the entire movement. But I think for me, one of the most prominent, one of the most interesting, one of the most influential in various areas was Helen Duncan. I think she's absolutely fascinating.
Well, there we are. That was Ash's Cabinet of the Intransigently Bizarre. Okay, next feature, one that I've been looking forward to because it's always good to have a good heated debate. It's for Quandary.
Not sure. I don't know what to think. I don't know.
The Quandary.
Okay, and the quandary this week is, should vaccinations be mandatory? And that comes with a massive asterisk saying, should those that are able to be vaccinated be vaccinated? We're mentioning this because measles is back in America. In 2000, the US government announced that measles had been eradicated in the States. But there's been a case, very famous case, in Disneyland, where apparently 59 cases have arisen from one unvaccinated child that can be traced to Mexico, I believe. And because vaccination rates are a lot lower than they should be, apparently in Colorado it's as low as 86%. So because of this, measles is back in the States. So should we make it the law that if you can be vaccinated against measles, then you should be vaccinated against measles? So who wants to take that on first?
Well, what's everyone's opinion first? Just a yes or no, or I don't know. Might be a useful way to kind of just gauge ideas.
Well, I would say no, with a significant caveat that if you don't, it shouldn't be compulsory, but if you don't, then maybe you don't go to school, or you don't go to the swimming pool, or you don't go out in public as well.
Mm. Now, that would be my position, because there's one article that's been doing the rounds saying that we should be ridiculing anti-vaccine parents.
Oh, I saw that. That was absolutely awful.
Yeah, and I just thought, no. For several reasons. One, if you start ridiculing people, one, they're not going to take your side. They're not going to think, oh, this person's completely ripping me to pieces. I know, they must be right. And also, if you ridicule people like that, then they will just disappear and they won't engage with you and they will leave their kid unvaccinated. So don't go ridiculing people.
Very true.
Yep, couldn't agree more. All you do is just increase the in-group, out-group mentality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I think there should be as much coercion as possible. I don't think you can mandate vaccines to be a legal requirement. And if you don't vaccinate your kids, then, I don't know, your kids get taken away or whatever. Don't think you should do that. But I do agree with Geraint in saying that they should be able to say that, right, okay, if you're not going to vaccinate your child, then your child can't do the fun things. Then your child can't go to swimming pools and stuff like that. That would be my position.
That there would be some other consequence.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's based on incredibly strong scientific evidence that, you know, it's really a useful thing and there's no danger to it. Yes, you get some cases where you react to it in a negative way. But you get that with every vaccine. So, I mean, people have to be made to understand or convinced that the science is incredibly strong, and therefore it's overall a good thing to do. I mean, I know we broaden it out to the Wakefield debate, but I'm constantly amazed that just one study has had such an incredible effect, particularly in this country. I mean, I'm just looking at some stats here. The 98 pre-Wakefield, there were 56 measles cases, and 2008 post-Wakefield, there are over 1,300 cases. And it's just that one study has had an effect. And I think, I mean, there's lots of things wrapped up in that. Mostly, I think, because the fear of autism and the complete unknown about autism, and we don't truly understand how it's caused, and that's what's wrapped in all that. But I'm amazed that one study has had such an effect on people's perception of how safe.
Yes, and people still bring up that study. I know BuzzFeed isn't particularly the most scientifically literate place to go, but looking at some of the comments under vaccine articles on there, I've seen a few times people say, oh, well, the Andrew Wakefield never actually said in the study specifically that vaccines cause autism. And I did have a look at the study, and obviously because it's a scientific study, it doesn't use general English of, yeah, vaccines absolutely cause autism. The information is there within the study that kind of tells you what's happening. So it's I think a lot of it is maybe it's an educational level. People aren't shown how to really look at evidence. I think that's something that schools should address. I was talking to somebody the other day about whether schools should include modules on law and politics and philosophy. I think they absolutely should. Because I left school knowing very, very little about politics. And I left school knowing very, very little about science outside of the fact that certain gases in a balloon will make it burn. Mm. And we can make little twirly bird things out of paper. And that was kind of what I left school with, that level of knowledge. And it's only after that I kind of fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
You mentioned Colorado. So there's an interesting case in the States. It makes a quite interesting case. So in that same article, I got the story about the finches in Nature. There's a number of articles about measles as well, and they say that the level of measles is not high in the US anyway. But kind of interesting that, so you said in Colorado there's a relatively low level of vaccination now. So that's a state which considers itself kind of free, and it's a bit hippie, and people like to think for themselves. It's, I would argue, a probably quite educated level of people on average. So people are thinking, oh, I'm thinking for myself, I'm making this choice, even though the choice is wrong. Whereas in Mississippi, which has got the highest level of vaccination and therefore the lowest level, where in general educational levels are lower, but yet they accept, you know, what they're told about the vaccinations, so they vaccinate their kids and they don't get the measles. Sometimes people having too much information can certainly be a bad thing, I'm thinking. I know that's not a new revelation, that's for sure. But, no. Sometimes you've got to take it as read, that no one's trying to pull the wool over your eyes in some things, that's for sure.
Sure. Well, a couple of points I'd like to make is that, well, the main one is that we can talk about statistics and percentages, but if you're a parent, then you're not going to, you're not necessarily going to make your decisions based on statistics and percentages. You're more likely to make it on emotion. I know that varies from person to person. And if someone scares you into thinking, for example, that vaccines cause autism, then that is gonna put you off vaccines. I don't know how you address that.
So there's also the issue that quite a few people tend to bring up under this situation, where people say, "Oh no, I don't want to get the vaccine because I don't want to risk autism." Well, first of all, we know vaccines don't cause autism, and also, I'm sure we all know plenty of people who do have autism. My flatmate is on the autistic spectrum, and it varies from person to person. I've heard it said quite a few times that. Why would people have a problem with autism, but they're perfectly fine risking a potentially life-threatening illness like measles? It's bizarre. It confuses me why people would be willing to take that type of risk, a potentially life-threatening condition, because they have this idea in their mind that autism is so bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
It's just the fear of the unknown. People can understand what measles is, and they see that it's not a killer in this country, but autism is a lifelong, thing that you have, and people don't understand why, how it's, what the cause of it is fully. So, mm-hmm. Fear of the unknown, I'd guess.
Well, sadly, we are running rather short on time for the quandary. So just to wrap it up, I'd like to go around and if you could say yes, no, or not sure to the question: should vaccinations be mandatory? Start with me. I'm a not sure. Geraint.
No, I don't think so.
Oh, you're a no. Okay. Ash?
I think I'm going to go with no, but with some of the caveats that we've discussed.
Okay. And Paul?
Again, no with caveats.
So that's three no's versus a not sure. Interesting. More quandary next week. Not sure. I don't know what I think. I don't know!
The quandary.
Okay, now we come to... the acclaimed feature, it's flag news.
Do I have to stand for this?
No. Okay, off we go with flag news.
Flag news.
So flag news. The small flag news, it's about some little province in the middle of nowhere. Somewhere called Wales.
Never heard of it.
Yeah. So a UKIP candidate has been parachuted in. A guy called George Hargreaves, and he's a rather controversial character because he's called the Welsh dragon a sign of Satan.
So UKIP, it just keeps on giving. They really do.
Yeah. So UKIP saying that the Welsh dragon is a sign of Satan. This guy founded the Welsh Christian Party. He's kind of embarrassed himself there. But one of the things he did say was that the Welsh flag is the only flag to have ever had a red dragon on it. And I've looked through the annals of vexillology, and I think he's right. The flag of Formosa, what later became Taiwan, used to have dragons on it, but they're sort of all strangely multicolored.
The flag of Bhutan? Doesn't that have a?
It has a dragon on it, but it's white.
Oh, it's a white one. Okay.
You know, from a religious point of view, I almost kind of see his point that he's making, because obviously the Christian saint George slayed a dragon. So, although obviously I disagree, I can almost see why he'd go down that route.
Hmm. Yeah, and he's got a point. It does look fairly ferocious.
It is ferocious. That's the point. It's ferocious.
Yeah.
All things ferocious don't need to be satanic. Come
Absolutely.
On now. Indeed.
Okay.
I was going to say, with a Chinese partner, one of the points that she found rather confusing is that when we use the term dragon over here, quite often it's used to refer to the term, you know, like a woman of a certain age who we regard as a bit of a battle axe, whereas back home, the dragon is a creature of beauty, power, grace, elegance.
Wow. So there you are, Chinese dragon news. Exciting.
All agree that the Welsh flag is the top flag.
I think it's the most interesting in the UK, certainly.
There you go, I'll take that.
Yeah, it's definitely the most interesting of the nations that make up the UK. True. So that's just a taster. That's your first bit of flag news. Then you've got international flag news from Fiji. Now, the president of Fiji, President Bainimarama, I hope I'm saying that right. So President Bainimarama has announced that Fiji's current flag is going to be replaced, and the new one will be unveiled on the 11th October, which is the 45th anniversary of Fiji's independence. Now, Fiji became independent in 1970, where it became the Dominion of Fiji, back when we used to have dominions. Fiji's had a very checkered past. There's been lots of coups, lots of shifts in power, that sort of thing. Fiji became a republic in 1987, but they didn't change the flag. That would usually happen. So what does Fiji's flag currently look like? Well, President Bainimarama has said, we need to replace the symbols on our existing flag that are out of date and no longer relevant, including some anchored to our colonial past. The new flag should reflect Fiji's position in the world today as a modern and truly independent nation state. So the current flag has a light blue field representing the Pacific Ocean, a Union Jack in the canton, that's top left corner for those of you who don't know flag speak, and on the right you've got a shield with some sugarcane, a coconut palm, a dove of peace, and a bunch of bananas, and at the top of the shield is a lion holding a cocoa pod. So you can sort of see where he's coming from with the imagery there, because you know, a lion holding a cocoa pod,
it's a busy flag.
It is. I'm looking at it right now. It's also it's very, 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 very British, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Because most countries on independence from the UK will adopt a new flag at some point or other. You think of Canada, famously, with their cool new flag. South Africa, they used to have a red ensign, but that got replaced by the Prance flag, which was an absolutely horrible flag, which was associated with apartheid. So obviously they got rid of that. And these days, according to the president of Fiji, anyway, there are only three countries which retain a Union Jack in the canton, and that is Australia, New Zealand. The obvious ones. Can anyone think of what the third one is? It's not that far away from Fiji.
Samoa?
Good guess, but no.
Marshall
Islands?
Again, Singapore.
Good guess. Singapore? No, not Singapore.
It's not Nauru. Nauru?
No, but you're in the right area. It's a tiny Pacific nation with a population of about 10,000.
Don't know.
I think I need to put you out of your misery. It's Tuvalu.
Tuvalu, yeah.
Ah, right, on tip of my tongue there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to go Vanuatu, but
no, very close. Now,
classic mistake, Paul.
Yeah. although, I've got to say, Tuvalu's flag has had a very interesting history in its own, because I think it's the only country that did have the Union Jack, then abandoned it, then bought it back again. That may be true because it became independent in 1978 and adopted its new flag, which featured nine stars, one for each island. Then someone had a brainwave in 1995 and said, hang on a minute, our name, Tuvalu, that means eight together, and we've got nine stars. One of the islands is inhabited, so let's get rid of one of the stars. A few months after that, in January 1996, they adopted this new flag, which wasn't based on the UK flag. They completely got rid of the Union flag / Jack. But it was really, really unpopular. People went, hang on a minute, we don't want to be a republic. We love the UK. We love the Queen. So they put the old one back in 1997 with all the stars. So there we are. That's the checkered history of the flag of Tuvalu.
Golly. I think have you just gone off on a flag tangent there, Tom?
a little bit.
What a surprise!
So yeah, that is the major flag news. Fiji is going to have a new flag.
So what's it going to be? Have they put out a competition for it?
Well, I very much doubt they'll have a competition like flagforliverpool.org.
No, indeed.
I'd imagine it will be limited to Fijians.
Yes, true.
And we will see what the flag looks like on the 11th of October, 2 days after my birthday. So that'll be a nice little present for me, a new flag in the world. Hooray.
Yeah.
So there we are. That was this week's flag news.
Flag news.
Right, we've reached the end of the show, and we've all got to go off and make pancakes.
Oh, I had my pancakes before we came on. I was prepared.
Oh no, I'm looking forward to mine. Absolutely.
Right. Got a question. I've got a question for you, actually, Geraint, as the resident non-atheist. Why do we have pancakes on Pancake Day?
Well, as I understand, it's because Lent is a period of fasting, and you're not eating all the nice stuff, so you cook up all the good stuff, all the sugary treats and that the day before, so you can have that before you're not allowed it during Lent.
Yes, absolutely. Which is why the French name is...
Shrove or something, isn't it, I guess?
No. Big carnival time in Louisiana.
Oh, yeah, it's Mardi Gras.
Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday, there we are.
It's Tuesday indeed.
Pancake knowledge, facts on the Skeptic Canary Show.
You know, I know it's too late now, but our quandary, considering the day, should really have been, is it a crepe or a pancake?
Indeed. Ooh.
Oh,
I know.
What type of Ash, did you have a thin pancake or a fat pancake?
I had a thin pancake, which I believe would be a crepe, am I right?
Yeah. Crepe or crepe, however you want to pronounce it, is specific. Pancake is generic. A pancake is obviously any sort of, it's not really a cake, but any cake thing you make in a pan, and that would include crepes and Scotch pancakes. Maybe even drop scones, I'm not sure.
Really?
Whereas crepes are specifically flat and thin, and Scotch pancakes are fat and light and airy and delicious. Pancake
news. This is a service we provide, a semantic service. I love this.
It'll be very interesting to everyone a few days after Shrove Tuesday. But yeah. Pancakes are not just for Shrove Tuesday. You can have them any time, really.
You can. Do not let your calendars be dictated by Pancake Day. Free the pancakes, have them any time you want.
Exactly right.
Here.
Right, so we've come to the end of the Skeptic Canary Show, episode 61. So, anyone got any plugs? Ash, I think you're on tour.
Yes, I am, starting in May, and I'm touring How to Talk to the Dead, which I've performed at the Fringe several times over the past few years, and that's touring around the whole of the UK to skeptics in the pub groups. So you can find out more information about whether it's coming to your city or nearby at ashprice.co.uk, and that's Price with a Y.
Yes,
and that starts from May.
There we are, fantastic. Anyone else got any plugs? Because I don't really have any.
Not really on the skeptic front, but just to say that myself and my wonderful colleague Grace have decided to enter this year's Leeds Half Marathon.
All right.
Running for the Jane Tomlinson Run for All charity. So get behind us, support us, supply us with hot drinks, kick our backsides out of the back door on rainy days, and cheer us on to the finish line on May the 10th, please.
Have you got a website that people could go to if they want to donate?
Not yet, no.
Okay.
We've not been sent our donation packs yet, but as soon as we do, I will let you know.
Fantastic. Geraint, anything to plug?
Nothing to plug, just everyone can find my exciting life, of course, at Liverpool Plants, where you get a mix of science, cycling, Norwich City, and scepticism.
Fantastic. And if you want to enter a flag into Liverpool design competition, go to flagforliverpool.org. I've been given the money by the awesome foundation, and I have ordered a bunch of superb, high-quality flags, which will be hitting the streets of Liverpool in about a fortnight's time.
So what are you going to do with them, Tom?
I'm going to fly them around, I'm going to have some professional photos taken, and I'm going to put them on the website, and I'm going to go to the council. Look, flags! You could have one of these. That's what I'm going to do.
Excellent.
So yes, we have reached the end of the show. It's goodbye from Ash Price.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Geraint Parry.
Tatty bye.
Goodbye from Paul Hopwood.
Goodbye, everyone. It's been a lot of fun tonight.
And it's goodbye from me, Tom Williamson, from SkepticCanary.com. Bye.